We, the Future, by Cliff Lewis, an audio excerpt read by the author. Plan A, Activation, Step 1, Run for Your Life. My chest, like the future, was burning. Still, I ran up the mountain trail. Even with the sun so low, with daylight running out, the birds went on chirping like they had all the time in the world. Nobody told them it wouldn't last. I wheezed and ran on. Once I reached the mountaintop, I gave myself permission to catch my breath, only a little. The inhaler in my pocket could open my lungs, flood me with sweet, cool oxygen, but not yet. I reached for the other pocket instead. Mom's phone. 1985. Invalid PIN. 1234. Invalid PIN. 1027. My birthday. I'm in. I opened YouTube and hit record. I know how the world ends, I panted. Just ran up Marduk Pinnacle in Carbon Hill, Pennsylvania, but I'm not supposed to run this much because an asthma attack, like the one I'm having now, could kill me.
Cliff Lewis reading the opening of his recent novel, We the Future, as young Jonah runs up Marduk Pinnacle in Carbon Hill, Pennsylvania. And the title of the chapter is Run for Your Life. So running is important in the tale. Jonah chokes out the words, I know how the world ends. And perhaps we'll learn the answer. After all, the last chapter of the book is titled The End of the World as We Know It. Jonah opens this chapter with these words, the last chapter, we are running out of time. The very last chapter, we are running out of time. Now, the plea means that they've taken too long pounding candidate yard signs into neighborhood lawns, that they're late for their rendezvous with the rest of the crew. Then again, it could be a universal plea for the world to wake up in the face of the looming climate crisis. We are running out of time. If you'll pardon the pun, author Cliff Lewis is a runner, and he'll tell us he actually wrote a good deal of the book while he was on his daily runs. Lewis is a native of northeastern Pennsylvania, but he now lives in Lancaster County, where he writes professionally day and night. Cliff Lewis returned to his home turf to talk with us about his ties to the region and We the Future, just in time for Earth Day.
I have family that has been living in this area for generations. My grandfather, who passed away a couple years ago, owned land that was deeded to the family by George Washington. So yeah, the roots go back deep. So I grew up around here. I grew up kind of in the shadow of Bald Mountain. So just outside of Scranton, Abington Heights alumni. So I love the area. I love coming back to visit every chance I get. And I especially love the pizza. So I will be bringing stacks and stacks of it home with me tonight.
When you were a student at Abington Heights, what kinds of subjects struck your fancy? Did you like English? Were you a science guy?
Yeah, as a student, I wasn't much of a reader. Like, I probably had some undiagnosed ADD or something going on. So I wasn't even a very great, like, much of a student until I got just around the end of high school. And I had this sort of, I don't know, this preternatural burst of motivation. And I got really invested, got into some advanced English courses, and we had summer reading. And that was one of the first times as a approaching young adulthood when I'd really sat down and read literature. So my English teacher, Mrs. Bailey, she had us read A Passage to India by E.M. Forrester. And I just remember reading that book over the summer and the way that Forrester painted a cinematic moment at the conclusion of that book really moved me. And I hadn't realized that the written word could be so visual and striking and have such dynamism to it. So that experience is one of the big sparks for me in getting invested in writing and literature.
You talked about growing up near Bald Mountain. Did you get outside a lot as a young lad? Were you out playing? Were you out hiking?
Oh, yeah. My family had about 100 acres of woods and forest and fields near the house. So I grew up in that very idyllic. I had a very idyllic childhood and playing in the woods, playing in the field. There was a forest right near our house that my dad always called the dangerous woods, which I think was supposed to keep us out of it. But of course, it only made us more invested in getting there as often as possible. So yeah, it was pretty idyllic. It was a great childhood.
Well, you had that terrific experience with E.M. Forrester and the power of literature late in your high school studies. What did you do then? Did you go off to college?
Yeah. So I attended Millersville University in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So I studied English there as an English major, and I didn't exactly know how I was going to use it, but I just got to read books for 4 years, which I really liked, and I learned how to write and learned how to write fiction and write poetry, and that gave me a lot of the skills that I use today in my creative work.
What kinds of writing were you doing in college?
Actually, another Northeast PA connection. So for my first year of school, I was at the Penn State branch in Worthington. So I had a creative writing course at Worthington where it was a really simple course. And at first, it just seemed like an easy A because all you had to do was show up and write in a journal and then read it to the class. But you had to do it every day. And we could write anything we wanted. We could write about what we did that day, or we could muse upon our philosophies of the universe. It could be anything, but we'd have to write it, and then we'd have to read it to the class the next day. And that repetition, again and again and again, of creating something on the page and then having to present it, really showed me what it meant to write creatively. And I never really lost that ability or those muscles. And that's what I use now as I write books.
You said you majored in English, but you weren't sure how it would serve you. Once you had your degree, what did you do?
Oh man, I am so lucky because I spent 4 years just reading books and writing musings. And then right near the end, the beginning of my senior year, I had a professor who suggested that I apply to an internship at a marketing advertising agency nearby. And I thought, sure. And it was a paid internship, which I think all internships should be. And so I had the opportunity to do that and quit my summer job and do that instead. And I discovered pretty quickly that that was an area where I could take my creative skills, my creative writing skills, and continue to do that to pay the bills. And I still do work in advertising. So that's also my day job today. And I'm very thankful for it. I mean, it wasn't on my radar when I was studying English, but it turned out to be really the perfect fit for the skill set I'd built up.
You talk about being a storyteller. At what point did your storytelling take shape in the form of short stories or novels? How do you look at storytelling in your life?
Yeah, I mean, that goes all the way back to being in third grade, and I had a teacher, his name was Mr. Griffiths, and he was really encouraging to me. I have a great dad, but he was sort of like also a father figure. He was just that kind of a teacher. And I remember for Christmas that year, I really wanted to give him a special gift. So I thought, I'm going to write him a story. So I wrote him a little book and I illustrated it and I gave it to him. It was the first story I ever really wrote. And then year after year through school, anytime there'd be any kind of creative assignment, I would find a way to subvert the assignment and turn it into writing a little book. And I figured out how to bind the books myself, deconstructing old books we had in the house and gluing my pages into it. And so I've been doing that kind of work and writing fiction in little ways since I was little. And then as I, after college, I started to realize, you know what? I think I have the chops to do something like this in a more substantial way. So it was short stories first and then novels.
I wonder if you'd read for us the first line, the first sentence of We the Future, your new novel.
Yeah, the opening of the book is from the point of view of a boy named Jonah, and it opens, "My chest, like the future, was burning."
That line, "My chest, like the future, was burning," sets up the story you're about to tell perfectly. But it also tells us, I think, something about you, the author. It suggests that the author is also burning with passion, and the story we'll read is filled with your passion about life and literature and the world we all share.
That means a lot to hear that. And it's funny because it reminds me of some of the reviews, some of the trade reviews I got when this book came out. And one of them was from Publishers Weekly. And what they said was, they said, I actually have the quote in my head because it meant a lot to me when I read it. They called this book an impassioned debut infused with friendship and community care. And I loved that so much that it's burned into my mind because it's exactly what I wanted to create with this book.
How did you zero in on this age group and yet on something that's so important to all of us?
Yeah, so the whole inspiration for this book began really with the premise. And I was listening to an interview on a podcast with an author named David Wallace Wells, and he wrote a nonfiction book called The Uninhabitable Earth. And it's really about playing out very credible worst-case scenarios when it comes to the climate crisis. And in the interview, he said he's always surprised that in popular storytelling, we don't have a lot of well-known properties of stories that are about the climate crisis that address it directly. It's easy to find stories that address it metaphorically, but not directly. And when he described that, I felt like he was sort of laying down the gauntlet. And I felt like, oh, this is the kind, I could tell this kind of story. And it really sparked in my mind pretty quickly that one of the most powerful ways to represent the climate crisis, which is all too often abstract in our minds because it feels far in the future, was to actually put a face and a voice and a personality on the future in the form of a person who travels from the year 2100 to the 2020s to launch a climate strike big enough to rewrite history. So that idea just crystallized very quickly when David Wallace Wells laid down the challenge in that podcast interview I listened to a few years back.
Where is the story set geographically?
So this is a sort of a hypothetical town. So it's called Carbon Hill, Pennsylvania. And it's very much inspired by the towns I've hung out in as a kid in Northeast PA. So there's a little bit of Carbondale in there. There's a little bit of Scranton in there. And then there are some towns also composited into it from more like South Central Pennsylvania, where I live now. So there's a little bit of Lancaster, PA. There's a little bit of York, PA as well. And it's just kind of a conglomeration of all of that. It's a community that was once a really big coal boom town. The coal eventually started to run out, and now that town is really anchored economically by a giant coal burning power plant, which is really what, for the main character Jonah, sets him off on his journey, because he realizes early in the story that he's come down with a really serious life-threatening case of exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, asthma, which can be a problem for people who live in these communities that are in close proximity to these kinds of emissions.
What were you up to when you were Jonah's age? Were you politically savvy in any way?
Absolutely not. No, as a 12-year-old going on a 12 and 13-year-old, I was very, very much just trying to figure out who I was, and pretty myopic in that regard, and not very concerned about the wider world at that point. So I really wanted to be a skateboarder, and I could not figure out how to skateboard, but I thought the kids who skateboarded were really cool. So tried to get in with those kids, but I had to consistently hide the fact that I couldn't really skate. You know, that was my world at 12 and 13. So I don't relate to Jonah's earnestness. Jonah's passion is really based on the passion I've seen in the young climate activists that I've met, some of whom were direct inspirations for this book.
Right from the start, you are frank. You don't sugarcoat the situation to make it easier for young readers to handle.
That's really important to me when it comes to We the Future, the way I wrote this book. I wanted to write a book that was as pessimistic as possible in that David Wallace Wells sense of saying this is how bad it could be, but also as optimistic as possible in terms of what people power can accomplish when like-minded people who are driven by the same values align themselves with one another and fight for systemic change. So that was how I wanted to write the book. I'm also well aware of the fact that climate anxiety is a big problem for young people right now. 75% of young people report being frightened when they think of the future. So I wanted to write a book that could tell young people that those feelings are real, those feelings are legitimate. However, when you align yourself with other young people who are feeling the same way, you can trade those feelings of isolation and hopelessness for feelings of solidarity and power. And so We the Future is trying to dramatize a young person going from anxiety and fear to empowerment and hope.
You mentioned coming into contact with young climate activists. How did that happen?
It was very serendipitous. So I now live in Lancaster County. And there was a congressional campaign a few years earlier that was really exciting to a lot of people who were invested in the climate movement. Just some of the policies that this candidate was going to stand for was very exciting. So climate activists, actually, some of whom came from all over the world, came and stayed in a movement house in Lancaster and volunteered their time to work for this campaign. My family had volunteered to be what we call the staging location for door knocking and canvases. And some of these activists from an organization called Sunrise Movement were assigned to our house. So they were kind of working out of our house weekend after weekend after weekend. And I got to see these young activists at work firsthand. And what I saw in them was a dogged determination to make use of every possible free moment to advance the cause. So they'd have a little lunch break and they wouldn't just eat their lunch. They'd pull up a dialer and put a little earbud in and do some phone banking while they're scarfing down their lunch. I noticed their determination, but I also noticed that it was all driven by a sense of joy and community, that they felt like they were saving the world. So they weren't workaholics, you know, they had an urgency, but it was sort of a joyful and really community-driven urgency.
Jonah, with his asthma, is vulnerable at the start of the story. So take us through a bit of his journey into community and the cause.
Yeah, so in We the Future, when we meet Jonah at the opening of the story, he is not just riddled with climate anxiety, he's also riddled with social anxiety. And nothing scares him more than the thought of approaching another kid and trying to start a conversation. You never know where a conversation is going to go. He doesn't know what he's going to say. He clams up. When he meets Sunny, this girl from the year 2100, on a mission to launch a climate strike big enough to rewrite history, Sunny knows that the best way to make this happen is through people power and organizing, and that can only happen through conversations. So she pushes him, sometimes physically, to go up to the doors of former friends that he once was close with and rebuild that connection and recruit them into their mission. And so as that story progresses, we watch how Jonah kind of starts to discover not just, you know, his weaknesses and his fears, but his personal superpowers and what unique abilities he has. Even some of the secret superpowers that he viewed as social anxiety, he realizes that in some cases, it's actually a really profound ability to read people. And so he discovers a lot about himself along the way as he makes these friends and builds power in his community.
Mom is very important to Jonah, and she's an interesting character.
Yeah, yeah. He's very close with his mom. And that's one of the biggest challenges for Jonah in this story, is because his mom is a very justice-minded person, a really firebrand like Jonah, but less anxious than Jonah. And one of the problems, though, is that she actually is employed by this economic anchor of the community. She works at the coal-fired power plant on the security team. And he feels like if she knows about the work he's doing, he won't be in trouble. She will get herself in trouble by diving in headlong and making a lot of noise alongside him and his friends. And he doesn't want her to lose her job and to lose the scholarship that she has through her job to attend law school and become a public defender, which is her dream. So Jonah has to hide so much of what he's doing throughout the story from his mom, which makes things very difficult. And he makes a lot of big mistakes in the process.
There's an important moment in the story when Mom has to retrieve Jonah from a company security vehicle, and she tells him simply to talk, to tell her what he's done.
Yeah, and it's not much of a spoiler to say that his mother is a veteran, and in fact a wounded veteran of the Iraq War. And, you know, when she finds out about what he's fighting for, she has to confess to him that there are some things she hasn't been totally honest with him about. And one of them had to do with one of the circumstances around which she'd been injured. And it actually involves military contracts and is actually tied to the coal company that operates out of their community, and basically reveals to Jonah that she has very good reason to want to be invested in this fight alongside him. You know, the whole book is about him learning that hiding himself from people and creating distance between himself and other people is always going to keep him from the power that he feels like he needs to make the change that he wants to make.
And we can imagine young people reading Jonah's story and thinking, well, I could do this. We could do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really the goal, is I wanted to create a book that is a compelling story and doesn't feel educational when you're reading it, because it's a thriller. It has time travel and plot twists and screaming goats. But it also is a primer on community organizing, and gives young readers a toolbox to work with. It teaches about canvassing. There's a concept called deep canvassing. It's not named in the book, but it's about how to have a conversation with someone that's persuasive by starting with shared values and talking about hearing their stories and letting them talk and finding the doorway into a common thread between yourself and that person, and finding a way to draw them into the fight. So yeah, this book I would hope would make young readers feel like there is something I can do when you look at a problem in the world. And it could be the climate crisis. It could be a lot of other important issues that are concerning a lot of young people today. But this book tells them that when you align yourselves with other young people who feel the same way, you can accomplish great things.
Why did you call the main character Jonah?
It's a little biblical reference. So, you know, in the story of, in the Bible, the character of Jonah is like, he's supposed to be telling people that they are facing destruction, and he's supposed to warn people of that destruction. And famously in the story, he avoids that call and he gets swallowed by a whale, and then he accepts the call and he's spat out by the whale and he does his work of delivering that warning. Jonah feels a very similar in this book, this Jonah, my Jonah, feels a very similar sense of personal call to deliver a warning.
How is it that you know all the lingo? How is it that you know how to write like a 13-year-old talks?
I mean, well, it helps that I have a 13-year-old. So I like to talk to him, and I learn lingo from him. Although I wonder sometimes when I read it back, I'm like, I don't know, the lingo changes fast. Is it still, like, I don't say for real, no cap at any point in the book, and I think that's a big one now. But I do try, and the last thing I want this book to be is didactic or stilted. I don't want it to feel preachy. I don't want it to feel technical. I want it to be a people's book. So that was how I tried to write it. And in this case, it was for young people. So I wrote it like that.
What did your son say when he read the book?
He loved it. And he actually was involved in reading little bits of it along the way. So that was really helpful for me when I was first starting the book. And he was younger, it was a couple years ago, but he was able to give me thoughts. And there were always thoughts that like I wouldn't have considered. You know, wondering about, well, what is this character thinking at this point? Or like, you know, are they going to want to eat something? And, you know, so those notes are always really helpful.
What's the status of the book when it comes to reaching young people now? Is it in libraries? Is it in schools?
Yeah, it is in schools. It is in libraries. So it's out in the world at this point. And one of my favorite things to do is to actually visit a school and get to meet students and get to present about how this book came about. I've gotten the opportunity to do it several times, and it's always so exciting and just kind of fills my heart to see young people who have read this book, who have been impacted by it. There's one, kind of through the grapevine, I heard about this one boy who read this book, and it meant so much to him that he carries it with him everywhere he goes. He keeps it in his backpack all the time, and it's like this special reminder to him about, I would hope, about the power that he can wield.
How do people learn more? Do you have a website?
Yeah, so I do have a website, which is Hey, H-E-Y, Cliff, C-L-I-F-F, Lewis, L-E-W-I-S.com. But probably the best way to find me is actually just to hop onto Instagram, and my handle is that same phrase, Hey, Cliff Lewis. Check me out there, follow me. I'll be sharing stuff about this book on a regular basis, and there are links right there on my Instagram profile to find this book as well.
Cliff Lewis, author of the young adult novel We the Future, issued by Jollyfish Press of Minnesota, speaking with us on a visit from his current home in Lancaster to his home turf, his original home turf here in northeastern Pennsylvania. For more information online, of course, he just told us that he has a website, and it's heycliffluis.com, H-E-Y-C-L-I-F-F. L-E-W-I-S.com, heycliffluis.com, or go right to the publisher, jollyfishpress.com, jollyfishpress.com. We the Future, just in time for Earth Day.